All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what's happening? Mark Maron here. This is my podcast, WTF, how's it going? On the show today, June Diane Raphael is here. You might know her from her television work, her film work, her podcast work, that show with Mandzukas and her husband, Paul Scheer. How Did This Get Made, I believe, is the name of that bit of business. But she's here promoting a book that she's put together, Represent, the Women's Guide to Running for Office and Changing the World. Yep. She's also on Grace and Frankie. Been doing that for years now. I was happy to talk to her. I thought she was mad at me. It's been a long time since I've had a guest that I thought was mad at me, but she wasn't mad at me. So I figured out how to do a Spotify playlist and share it on my Instagram stories. So Grandpa's doing all right, huh? Keeping up with the kids. I know how to do that. By the way, the world is still ending, and I'm not numb to it nor normalizing it. I'm trying to enjoy what I've worked for without destroying it more and without being really negative right now. Is that okay? In other words, I'm in a certain amount of intentional denial and ignoring it. And here was my plan, though, is that, tell me if you like this idea. So I've got these dates coming up. I got Detroit. I got Chicago, which is sold out. I got Minneapolis, Toronto. All these are happening. So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting or clever or fun or something that I could engage my dumb brain with and waste time in creating regional-oriented playlists on Spotify and then share them on my stories with the upcoming dates for the city that I'm going to, that where the music is from. Huh? What do you think of that? Pretty good branding idea, wouldn't you say? I would say so. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all the upcoming dates. So that's my big Spotify idea. Thank you for all the emails about my cat monkey. You're right. I should go to the vet. I'm going to go. I'm going today. As I told you, Monkey seems to be losing weight, but he's very perky. He's very excited, and he's running around. He's eating a lot. He doesn't seem compromised in any way, other than he looks a little smaller than he once did, because he's a little old man now. But enough people have red flagged the possibility of kidney problems, hyperthyroidism, pancreatitis problem. Like, he's old, and he's doing okay, but yeah, I guess I should go in. It's just the idea, man, of getting these fucking cats in the cage. I don't know what kind of cat you have or how well they're behaved, but to get Monkey in the cage, I think, is not as hard as once he's in there, he's going to shit, he's going to piss, he's going to, like, howl. Fonda, like, is impossible to get in the cage. She gets in the cage, pisses all over everything. Lynn was trying to get me to get this sort of, like, little bag that you put your cat in. You lay the bag on your legs, and you put your cat on your lap, and then you wrap him up in this little bag, and his head sticks out, and it's real easy, and just carry him to the vet like a little papoose. Is that what you call him? Like a little baby in a little bag with his head sticking out, and it's like, not my fucking cat. You can stop that little idea at put the cat on your lap for any amount of time. I mean, Monkey will climb on my lap, but they know, man. There's no way I'm going to be able to wrap my cat up like a little enchilada and bring him like a cute little thing to the vet. My cats are terrified monsters. Get into the cage, shit, pee, howl. It's a mess when I get there. They don't want the vet to touch him, and I feel like I'm going to take a year or two off his life just to get his goddamn blood work done. But I should do it right. I can't just let him die. That's a bad feeling. You could have saved him. He had 15 years. I'll bring him in. I get it. I'm bringing the cat in. All right. So the cat thing is being handled. I'll handle it. Sorry, I'm punchy. I drank coffee, man. It's amazing. Fucking addiction, isn't it? Can I talk to you about that for a minute? Negotiating with the monkey on my back, the nicotine monkey. So I've been off for 3 weeks. I put on a few pounds. I had 3 fucking slices of mediocre pizza last night, and I ate them like I was running out of time in my life. That if I was presented with a situation like, you're going to die in about a minute and a half, there's nothing you can do about it, but, and the only option you have to in this minute and a half is to eat as much of this pizza as possible. That's all. So if you find any joy in that, you can either just sit there and wait to die, or you can eat as much of this pizza as you want in the minute and a half you have left to live. That's how I ate pizza in a public place at a party at someone's home yesterday. Most people were taking one piece and just enjoying the one piece. I took one piece, took a bite out of it, got mad that it didn't have tomato sauce on it, got a piece with tomato sauce, started eating that. Then there was another, then more pizza came out. It was a fucking pizza clusterfuck in my face, in my mouth. So I know it's not a big deal. You're probably like, hey man, people eat pizza. I guess they do. I guess, yeah, people eat pizza, but I didn't feel great about it. And then I get today, I'm like, you know, do I have to live like this? There was a thing that happens when you engage your addiction. Okay. This one I thought was pretty minor, nicotine, but it puts a lid on the box. You know, if you look at yourself as a box, you don't want the box open to where things can come out and go in easily when there's no way to regulate, you know, what's inside the box, because you're missing a roof. You're my being, my soul, my personality. The roof, it gets blown off the fucking thing as soon as I take out the plug. Nicotine was the plug. It was the great leveler. It was the thing that kept me grounded, that kept me from losing my mind. And I just take that out of the picture. And all of a sudden, hey, man, where's my fucking roof? Where's the roof to me? Gone. So the elements are coming in. I want to get out. It's raining. I'm trying to rebuild the roof, and I've got very few tools. Fuck it. Enough of that metaphor. What I'm saying is, like, hey, wouldn't it be easier just to fucking do it? Maybe you can manage it, man. Just, you know, have one or two, you know, a day. You know, take it easy. Fuck. Not going to do it. But that's what's going on. So I get rid of the nicotine 3 weeks in. I'm like, I can have coffee now. Let's go. Something's got to get me jacked. I haven't had coffee in over a year or two. And God knows I get enough coffee from justcoffee.coop. They keep sending me coffee. So I've had some of that. That's pretty good. But you know where that leads? Back to nicotine. Yeah. This is the dance I do, but it's with mundane substances. I'm not vaping. I'm not shooting dope. I'm not snorting fentanyl. I'm not vaping. I'm not shooting dope. Hey, yeah, I think musical theater is going to happen. Fentanyl is not for me. I don't do that type of drug. Nicotine, 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 caffeine, 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 pizza, 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 pizza. Let's go on a hike. What's the point? I'll write the rest of that musical later. It's called Managing. Managing the Monkey. That's the name of the musical. So, folks, look, justice. Is there justice? I'll tell you a story. The roof is off of my soul. I've got no roof. The structure of my being is roofless. No roof. Just stuff flying out and flying in. I need to put a lid on it, man. I find that with the lack of nicotine and with the lack of sort of a regulating device for my emotions and thoughts that, you know, I think this happens, though, like, you know, where does the justice, you know, you see what's going on in the news, you see people getting away with the shameless corruption and horrible kind of deregulating leading to the environmental disaster. It's a fucking nightmare every day. So where do you find justice in the world? And it dawned on me that you find it in little things. So I got this car. I got a Toyota. I got an Avalon, which is a nice Toyota, but it's not a Lexus. It's for the person that's sort of like, I don't want to buy a Lexus because then I'll worry about it. And why don't I just get the Avalon? Because that's just a Toyota at the end of the day. It's not a Lexus that you have to worry about. So that's what I got. Now, it's a nice enough car where you would think they'd have practical things for you to use when you say you want to comb your hair in the mirror. Now, for somehow or another, the light in this car at night and the lights available in the car at night do not enable you to see your whole head. It's just a fucking reality. Like, if I park at the Comedy Store and I left my house with wet hair, these are big problems. These are fucking deep problems. These are what's happening now. If I want to comb my hair out Before I go into the Comedy Store, I look in the mirror with the light on, the you know, the interior light, not enough light to see my hair. Just I can just see my slightly illuminated face, which doesn't help me. And then, oh yeah, there's a visor mirror with a light in it. Okay, I'll pop that open. Not enough light to see my hair, just my face. So what the fuck are my options? Then I got to get my cell phone out, turn the light on the phone, turn it around to my head so I can try and comb my hair like that, or just like not get so hung up on my hair. Hey man, what are you worried about your hair for, man? You're all right. You're one of a kind. You're the real deal, right? Just go out with whatever kind of hair you want, man. Own it, man. Just own it. There's no one like you. What difference does it make? That's my my new one of a kind character. Hey man, yeah, I'm kind of an asshole, but there's no one like me, right? I show up, I do the work, I'm one of a kind. They'll put up with it, I'm one of a kind, man. Yeah. You like them? Yeah, man, I'm known for my shit, man. And there's no one does what I do, so, you know, I'm difficult, but people will put up with it. You know why? Because no one's like me, man, one of a kind. The point is, like, it's upsetting. It's a design flaw. And I had a moment where I'm like, someone should alert Toyota that at least the Avalon model does not have the proper design to self-groom in a reasonable way. And I think that someone should be responsible for this. Take the hit. Where does the blame fall? You know, who is the guy with the sketches on his computer of how these lights work in this particular model of car, to where at night with the interior lights on, no, can't see my hair. With the visor mirror lights, can't see my hair. Got to go in and just assume that I look all right. Of course you look all right, man. There's no one like you. You're one of a kind. Don't worry about what people think. No one's like you. Why would you worry what people think, man? You're fucking one of a kind. Hey. So I haven't written that email. Stop me, please. Just stop me. Let me cover that idea with pizza. That'll stop me from being the person that leaves a Yelp review about anything. Look, folks, listen to me. June Diane Raphael. I know her. I know her husband, Paul, from the comedy world. I know, and we've met many times, and I thought that there was a little tension because I almost had them on when she made a movie with her writing partner, and I didn't, and I thought she was mad at me. I'll cover that with her. She's got a book out right now, Represent, The Women's Guide to Running for Office and Changing the World. She co-authored that book. She always can be heard on How Did This Get Made, the podcast she does with her husband, Paul Scheer, and Jason Mantzoukas. And all 5 seasons of Grace and Frankie are streaming on Netflix now. Season 6 comes out early next year. This is me talking to June Diane Raphael. Were you mad at me?
Let's address it.
Were you mad at me?
No.
For any period of time? Because
I was not mad at you, Mark Maron.
Oh.
I was frustrated because we have been trying to book a time to do your podcast. Casey and I, when we were doing,
we were
promoting our movie Ass Backwards.
Yes, which I watched.
Great. And I'm sure you watched in preparation for an interview that never happened. And yeah, see, I have no idea how down in the muck of your admin of the podcast you are.
Right, right.
But there were, you rescheduled a number of times very close to the recording time.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, I just had to say I'm not scheduling it again for this time.
Okay.
So
I apologize.
Apology accepted.
It was like, it was a bad time, maybe. And maybe I felt bad about it. And I felt, because the reason
so
I have.
You picked up on my anger.
Well, yeah, I mean.
Sure, most people do.
No, but I mean, like, I think you probably had a right to be mad at me. And I understood that. And these things happen. in the booking and the show business.
Of course they do. And
I'm always happy to see you, though.
I'm always happy to see you. And I do get really, I think at that time in my life, I also took that stuff very personally.
Yeah.
And that's silly, and I wouldn't now because I reschedule. I mean, I have a general meeting. I've been rescheduling for a year, just like going to keep on rescheduling.
Isn't that weird, though?
Yes. And so I do now understand that that is actually it's quite natural in
right.
the nature of things and yeah. people's schedules. But at the time.
Personal.
Yeah.
That fucking asshole, Marin.
Well, I just felt like, I felt like this is my time and I've organized the day around this.
Okay.
And at a certain point, I don't know that he wants to do this. And I may need to let him know that I feel the same way.
Nice. And I felt that. And this is like a big thing.
So that landed.
Yeah. She's like, fuck him.
Yeah.
He can't dick me around like this.
A little bit.
Well, yeah, okay, yeah. It's all justified, but like this is a long time ago, and like things have happened.
Of course,
the world is ending. You have children.
Yeah, right at that time, I decided to procreate. Just when I saw it all going down.
But it's weird though that you have to learn these things in this business, because I took it all personally too. I always took it all personally,
yeah.
Like when people. Yeah, you know, the assumption of people big timing you, that was another one where you have people you came up with and all of a sudden they're not getting not emailing back.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what it's about. Usually they're busy.
Sure. I know. And it's the same thing. Like I remember someone telling me when you are in school and you have to walk into a classroom and you're late and you walk in and you feel everybody staring at you.
Right.
And you're so conscious of your body walking over to your seat and you're conscious of sitting down and like settling into the energy of that space and just how intense an experience that is.
What grade is this?
This is any grade really, but I mean, I remember that just feeling like eyes burning through me and being so aware of myself. And then when you're the student in class and someone walks in late, you look up because something different has happened.
Right.
But that's it.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of it. You're simply noticing like a pattern has been disrupted.
Right.
Yeah. Something that was happening is now different and my eyes are going there.
Right.
But there's nothing else I'm thinking of.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I try to remember that it's really
nice.
Not about me.
I tend to think if I look down, I'm invisible. I like if I walk.
Not here.
Yeah.
I'm like two dimensional.
Yeah,
I'm just going to be a shadow.
Yeah, I'm
yeah,
just
you won't
worming
see
through the air. You can't see anything.
Yeah. I mean, I also was, so I'm 5'9". I was my full height at 11.
Really?
That's a very tall girl.
Wow.
So I was also very aware of my body and my stature and tried to make myself similarly like look smaller.
Were you hunched?
Yeah. And I remember having an acting teacher at NYU pull my shoulders back and really force me to.
Isn't that uncomfortable? Breathe. Like you like
breathe.
Feel like and you feel and it did it happen when you did that, did you realize like this is how it's supposed,
I
it's
cried.
Supposed to be?
I cried when she touched my shoulder.
Because when you open like that, you're like,
it's so vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah. I'm unguarded.
Yeah,
absolutely. You can see it.
Absolutely.
You can see it all.
Yeah, you can see all my pain.
Oh,
I thought I was hiding it so well.
I still feel it now.
Yeah, I know.
Are you like that? Do you walk like that now, regular?
I don't walk like that regularly. But if I need to open up, like I could just, like that could. Actually, when I get massages, I often cry because I have so many, like, pain points in my body.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Like, just when they're pushed on them?
Oh, yeah.
Now, okay, so, because I have that, too, and it's fairly general. What do you think it is? Why do we have to keep crying?
Well, I think our body stores grief and sadness and... Mm. Take a sip.
And we're funny people. And we push it down. We enforce it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think it's necessarily...
bad?
Bad or repressed. I think the pain of
being
the human experience. Yeah, and just our bodies storing memories. And
okay, so you're saying you're depressed. Are you in medicine?
I didn't know another way to say it. I just did it. I couldn't figure out how to get it out.
No. Did you grow up with a huge family?
I grew up with two older sisters.
Oh, how are they doing?
They're doing great. Mm. We're very close.
Really?
Very, very close.
Why
yeah.
do you... Now, your name is pronounced Raphael?
Mm-hmm.
Why did that happen?
It's how it's always been...
I don't know why I'm taking this tone with you. It's spelled Raphael.
Well...
I'm just telling you. I don't know if you know that. Like it's
so it's actually German and it's pronounced Raphael.
Oh, Raphael.
Yes.
Kind of like there's a little thing in there. It's not Raphael. It's like Raphael.
No, it's Raphael.
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 Okay.
Like Ray.
Feel.
Feel.
Okay. And Raphael. It was always like that.
I never changed.
And it's German.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I have accepted the pronunciation of Raphael. I don't mind it.
Seriously? Is that not one of the pain points?
No, because I actually like how... no, I like how... I know this is an audio medium that didn't play, but
did,
I just touched
did.
My chest. I like the way Raphael sounds.
Yeah.
And so I don't mind it, no. And I do think people get so caught up in... So what happens in that interaction is that I then have to take care of people who are worried they've said it wrong. And so I
Oh, I'm sorry.
Exactly.
It
becomes like a whole thing. And I'm like, it's okay. I actually don't care.
No. I'm sorry.
See? And I've got to respond to it. And I've got to make you okay. And it may be okay. It may not be okay, but I'm irritated.
Right. It's like, it's nothing you asked for.
Yeah.
To carry someone through it.
And I do think there's something important about struggling through a name.
Yeah.
I think that is okay for people to struggle through.
You mean
a
with
name.
Life or for
yeah,
them?
Just with names in general. Well, like not every name should be easy to pronounce.
I got a doozy. No one can get it.
You're kidding me.
It's ridiculous. Moran, Moron, Moron.
Do you really have it mispronounced?
Oh my God. And I'm like, how can it be? It's spelled
wow,
exactly.
Crazy.
It's like Baron with an M. Moran.
So when you're on the phone with like Time Warner.
Hey, Mr. Moran?
Yeah.
Marin?
See, I always say Raphael because it helps them wrap their mind around it.
But you don't have to deal with it. Wait, what?
No, because when they see that PH, they want to say Raphael.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's easier for me to then spell it once I've said Raphael.
Well, this is just one of the ways you're helping people.
Well, the other thing is whenever I book all of our hotel reservations and all of our travel arrangements, and I always book them under my name, and I find it so satisfying when they call up and say, Mr. Raphael, your car is ready. And I delight in it.
How's Paul feel about it?
He doesn't mind it.
No?
Mm-mm.
Paul Scheer, that's your husband.
Correct.
I've talked to him. I know him. Pleasant man. Funny.
He's the best.
Yep. But, okay, so you grow up, two older sisters in Rockville Center, Long Island.
That's right.
With parents?
Yes, I had them.
And what were they all about?
I had wonderful parents and my mom was a New York City public school teacher. My dad
really?
Was a union steam fitter, pipe fitter.
What job? What is that job?
Yeah. So that, I was thinking about it on Labor Day yesterday. So that job is handling a lot of New York City's radiators.
For the city.
For the city.
Mm.
Yes. Well, not always for the city. I mean, he worked on other union jobs too.
Right.
But, so pipe fitting was really dealing with all of the piping.
Wow.
It's sort of affiliated with plumbing, but they don't deal with like the air going through pipes.
Right,
I
not
hope
shit
this
pipes.
Is right. Exactly.
They don't want to be mistaken for the sewage guys.
Oh my gosh, if you call them a shit piper. No, they are up in the clouds looking down upon.
The vapor pipes.
Exactly, exactly.
So he's a union guy.
Union guy from the
solid,
Bronx.
Solid, middle class. Like Rockville Center was where they set up shop to have a family. It was nice.
Yes. I would say they bought a fixer-upper, and I definitely went to school with kids who were a lot wealthier than I was. Rockville Center is a fairly wealthy town.
Oh, okay.
And I was very much so aware of that, what we didn't have there, and the, you know... the socioeconomic differences in our town.
You could feel the presence of money.
Oh, yes. You could feel the presence of money from afar. And, right. Like, you were just sort of watching
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, like, how did you get out of it without having some sort of ridiculous New York accent or brogue?
I worked it out. I do have it. And it does come out.
When does
Mark,
it come?
It comes out. Mark Moran, it comes out.
Does it?
Comes out in anger. It's when I speak to my sisters. Did you talk to her?
Really?
What are you gonna do?
Oh my God.
Oh, it's terrible.
Come on.
Absolutely.
Where's that lady?
Buried. You'd have to give me a full body massage to let her out.
I'd have to make you cry and get angry.
Yeah, no, I've really done a lot of work on my voice too.
Oh my God. Let me just hear it the regular one again.
Oh, God. Although, okay, so there are some words I really struggle with. One is, oh, I have to spell it, O-R-A-N-G-E. I would like to say orange.
Orange. Yeah. Orange. Orange.
Orange.
That's what you would say.
I would like to say that.
Yeah. And what do you say?
Orange.
Orange.
I would
orange?
Like to say.
You want to say orange?
I desperately, desperately, with every fiber of my being, I would like to say. Pillow.
Pillow. For pillow.
But I do say pillow. I have to, that word I have to see and think P-I-L-L-O. I have to like look at it in my brain. It's so hardwired.
It's so crazy that you killed that person in you.
She had to go.
Why? It's one of the best accents ever.
Do you think so? It's
love
so
it.
Terrible.
The Long Island accent? Come on.
Oh, I don't like it. I don't. I hear it now and I'm very upset by it. I mean, my sister, who still lives on Long Island, still has hints of it. And I can...
Did they all try to kill it?
No. They both have a little, probably more than I do.
What about your folks?
Well, my dad was from the Bronx, so he had a thick Bronx accent. Right. And my mom was from Brooklyn. But they both had it.
Mm. God, it's so sad that you would revise history like that.
But that's the first thing you do when you go to acting school is try to work your accent out.
Is that true?
Yes. I went to NYU and at the Tisch School of the Arts, at the Stella Adler Conservatory of Acting, we had to take voice class was one of the first classes you took to make sure you had a neutral sounding voice.
They told you that?
Yes.
That seems crazy. I've never heard of such a thing. I didn't realize that that's what happened.
That's absolutely what happened.
That they were just like blank slating you people.
Yeah. So that you can take on another accent. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you could completely take on another accent without losing yours.
No, but isn't losing yours taking on another accent? Like, what are you taught?
No, you're right. It's problematic at best. You're absolutely right. I've never investigated it. I was just happy.
Yeah, to be there at
to
Tisch
pay for that. To pay good money to sound differently.
If the only thing you got at acting school was rid of that monster inside of you.
I think that's why they sent me there.
So did you act in high school? You were tall.
Yes,
you're uncomfortable.
Been tall.
Were you ostracized? Well, you were sociable, right? You were
funny. Not at all. But I mean, I played basketball. I was
jock.
The height was put to use.
Sure.
I didn't have a choice. I don't think I had a choice.
I always love those people, like those people that those really tall people that never touch a basketball, and you ask them if they play ball, and they're like. No. And when you run into those people,
it's an act of resistance.
It's the best. It's the best. Never.
And because
then they have to deal with what you deal with your name, which is like, wait, really? You never.
Why not? All the money.
Or whatever.
Or whatever.
You're supposed to.
Yeah, that feels against nature.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it, but I played basketball. And I mean, it was just hard. I mean, it was. Whatever, it wasn't that hard comparatively, but it was, I definitely remember towering over my teachers.
Wow.
Forget about the boys, just the teachers.
Are your sisters tall as well?
Yes, but not as tall.
Hmm. Where did it come from? Which?
My mom was tall.
Oh, really?
My dad was tall.
Oh, okay. You strike me as tall, but not like freakish.
And I don't think I am, but I think... If I was an 11-year-old sitting
maybe
here,
maybe you're not. I'm 5'11".
I'm 5'9".
You're not, but you're I don't know. It didn't. Yeah, if you were 11, it'd be weird.
It would be strange.
Yeah, it would be.
And that was, I think, for young girls, that's you are perceived as a woman before you're really, you are one. And so that I remember quite well, of just walking down the street and being being a child and feeling like, oh, wow, the world is perceiving me as a woman.
Yeah, is that, that must be a creepy feeling.
Oh, terrible. It's a horrible feeling.
Yeah, people.
Horrible.
Yeah, girls have it terrible because they dress up or they want to be appear as women. And then there's creepy guys going,
"Ugh." Well, I mean, I was just wearing like Umbros and T-shirts. Oh. But I was still getting attention and I knew, you know, I was not prepared for that.
Right. Well, okay. Who is?
I guess no one. Well, yeah, but I would like to think that I would prepare my children a little bit better.
What would you say to them? Do you have a girl?
No, I have two boys until they tell me otherwise. Yeah. But I would say, yeah, there are adults who are going to be looking at your body in a different way, and you have agency over it. And I don't care who that adult is, but you can tell people you don't want to be touched. And
right.
You don't want to be looked at, and yeah, I think I would try to. I think I absolutely would try to, especially
well, yeah,
a girl.
Well, the touching
prepare.
Thing, obviously, but
the
like,
touching thing, obviously, but especially with a girl at 10 or 11,
right.
Yeah, I think I would have that conversation.
Like they're going to start looking at you weird.
Yeah, and you're a child,
and you're not going to forget it. Yeah, and you're not going to know what it's about.
Yes,
and we'll discuss that later.
Yes,
but for now, don't respond to
it. Yeah, keep your head down.
You're invisible.
Yes.
It worked for me. But all right, so then you didn't know acting in the high schools?
I did the plays in high school and I loved it.
Singing?
But it was
any
also
singing?
I know I'm not a singer, which when you're doing high school theater, like that hurts.
Yes,
your chances.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there was a fall play and a spring musical
and
I just couldn't do one.
Right.
You know, I was the star of the fall plays and then the musicals I was like, you know.
Yeah.
Retail shop owner number three, like whatever I was, townsperson.
Right.
So
yeah.
I loved that whole, what I loved about theater in high school is just, it's so inclusive and just kind of like, we'll take everybody.
Oh yeah, yeah.
We'll take everyone.
The theater club.
Theater kids.
Yeah,
like, theater I just kids, love that.
Yeah, yeah. It's nice. It's,
it's
I think
so nice.
They turn out to be pretty good people, most of them.
Yeah, and it was just fun.
What made you decide you wanted to commit your life to it?
Oh, because I loved it so much.
That was it?
Yeah. I loved it so much and I didn't want to do anything else.
And did you have to audit? Were your parents like, okay, no problem?
My parents were incredibly supportive. I don't know why or how. It's actually one thing I regret not being able to talk to them about since they've passed away. Like, I having children now, I'm like, wow, that must be terrifying to see your child pursue
something so scary. And like without any security whatsoever.
That's insane.
Seemingly crazy.
Yeah.
Nothing you can do to stop them.
Nothing you can do to
without
stop them.
Hating
I'm just
you.
Like, will they survive? Like, how are they planning on surviving in this world? It seems so scary to me.
I know. It's true. I guess I don't know that I've ever fully executed the empathy to really see it that way from my parents' point of view. I think they were kind of self-involved. But they must have been worried.
It's terrifying. Your child is going into the most competitive career.
Well, I think, but isn't part of the terrifying thing is sort of like, she's going to be back home and we're going to have to.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, for me, I'm like, well, I'm also in a different stage with children, but I love them so much. Like, I'd like them to live with me forever. And,
right.
And us to be a very strange family. And,
right.
You know, I have
son,
no problem.
He's 40.
Yeah.
And
we're married now. You know? Paul's passed on, and now we're together.
It just seemed to make sense. He's in the house. And
no, I don't see that as a burden. I'm like, oh, I think that's so not, I would love that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I also have thoughts on like why we no longer have intergenerational homes, and I think how that's negatively impacted so many people. But specifically,
you do have thoughts
women,
about those?
Well, yeah, I think we used to.
What do you mean, like having the
grandparents in the house, having caretakers in the house, being able to take care of the elderly in the home, just having more
hospital bed in the living room,
potentially having more access to that like village of support.
Did you grow up with that?
I didn't. I mean, I grew up with, I mean, we went to go see my grandfather every weekend, but he was in a nursing home.
Right.
But I do believe that we're suffering under this new model, which is we're all in our separate little houses. The generations are kept separately. I don't necessarily think it's working.
Right. People don't even think twice. They don't even think to put their parents in the house anymore.
They don't think to put their parents in the house. And I also think that because aging and death and mortality is so scary to look at, that keeping it away and sanitized, I think the psychological impact that has on people in their middle age, where
culture,
we don't have
culture,
to look at it
because
we can keep them somewhere else.
So we don't have a realistic sense of it. Death.
Yeah, we don't have a realistic sense of it coming for us.
Right, and we believe vitamins work.
Right. Yeah. We're doing all these other things. And then also, I think we're not, our values are misplaced.
Hmm.
So I actually think it negatively impacts us and certainly elderly people.
Sad.
In major ways.
Well, there's such great sort of emotional and historical and human resources that that I think culturally we tend to neglect now. That there's no passing on of whatever that wisdom is, the humanity.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, capitalism has. I mean, once people are no longer able to produce, we have no use for them.
Mm.
And I think the elderly are a perfect example of that. We say we value children. We say we value old people. And I don't think our society actually does, because they cannot be a part of the workforce.
Right. And also, I think people have gotten very self-involved.
Mm-hmm.
That just by their day-to-day, this sort of complexities of modern life and the expectations of technology have sort of kind of eradicated parts of the heart and the emotional sensibility that used to be second nature.
Yes, and I think you're right about also not passing on verbal oral stories and traditions and getting a sense of history and getting a sense of things passing and people aging.
Yeah.
I think that's troubling.
It is, and so what are you going to do?
Well, I don't have. Well, I. What am I going to do?
I mean, it's one of those things. I know you're very active, and I want to sort of move through, like, some of the stuff that's in the book, because
I guess it's related to the book in a way.
So
my big, not that this is my personal thesis, but I do feel like caretaking is undervalued, and so much of it is not paid. Right, so. The caretaking I do for my small children is not paid. The caretaking I did for my elderly father was not paid at the end of his life. And
you took care of your dad?
Along with my sisters and his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
We all did. I don't think I did.
Right.
In fact, his primary caretaker was really his fiance and his girlfriend. But I think until we can have a conversation for women, especially, on who's doing that work, what is the value of it? And it also, to me, this extends to domestic workers, too, and the people who come into my home and my nanny who comes into my home to take care of my children and valuing and respecting that job,
it's
a paid job.
Yeah.
And also the domestic workers who take care of elderly people and invalids, that work is also undervalued.
And it's a huge, not only is it a huge business, but it's a necessary thing.
Yeah.
Like, and now with the boomers all creeping towards it.
But we're going to be, my generation is right in the middle. Yep.
Is one of the biggest sort of health industries around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's required.
Yes. But we also, I believe that these workers are underpaid and undervalued.
Yeah, of course.
When they're doing...
And a lot of old people are mean.
Sure. Yes, it's very hard work.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing people don't realize about coming into a domestic environment is it's not like there's an HR department.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
No,
you are interfacing
with years of God knows what.
And you're in a home setting. It's not a professional setting as you or I might understand it.
Right.
And so I do think professionalizing it is incredibly important for the safety of workers.
Sure.
And also for the value of the work that they do and provide.
No kidding. Yeah. My brother wants to get involved in the field somehow. Like, you know, he wants to get involved with home care, and there's a lot of stuff going on with it.
Yeah.
That's sort of interesting. But yeah, I do think that those people are probably underappreciated.
Yeah. But I also think this extends to just sanitizing death in general and the way
I know
we sort of grieve and how we process death and how we process bodies and all of it.
I'm not good at it.
Well, it's very hard.
Are you?
I don't necessarily want to be good at it. I've grieved the loss of my mother suddenly. I grieved the loss of my father after a long illness. So I've had sort of both a living grief and then also a very sudden traumatic one.
Right.
I guess I'm just curious about how we want to be comfortable around it, and we do that by kind of denying it, denying like actually seeing bodies and also talking about it and being with it. And
yeah, I think that's true. I deal with it myself now in my head.
Yeah.
Well, just sort of like, because my parents are still alive, and you know, I've lost quite a few friends or people I've known, but I'm still a little weird with it. My mother's weird with it, and everyone's been weird with it.
Yeah, I think most people are.
They just want to keep it away.
Yes.
Keep that fucking death away.
Right, right.
It fucks everything up, because it is really one of the only inevitable things that we're all going to experience.
And hurtling toward it in this moment.
Yeah, I'm hurtling. I mean, that's not that fast.
We're heading there.
Sure.
I'm closer to it now than I was when I pulled up.
Okay, that's fine. So again, this is probably a depression problem that you're...
No, and I think that's the interesting thing. I actually feel like I have a much greater capacity for joy and happiness.
Do you?
Yes, 1,000%.
Because of you've dealt with the grief and you understand.
I mean, I'm dealing with it. I don't see it as something, and I think this can be some of the misconceptions. Everybody has a different experience, but for me, I'm like, I think the desire is like, oh, you did that, like that. That was that time, and then you figured that out and dealt with it, and now you moved forward.
Yeah.
And the truth is, it's with me every day.
Sure.
It's a part of every decision I make, and it's...
And the inevitability of it.
Yeah.
I see, this is like, this is the thing I'm playing with in my brain, is that I think if people had if they weren't prone towards magical thinking and denial and terror of death, that if there was a reasonable way for human beings, given that they have consciousness, to just really, truly accept it as just what happens, that we'd all be better.
I agree.
But it's a tall order. You can do it intellectually. Like, I can sit here and look at you and go like, yeah, I'm going to die. I mean, you know, I just hope it happens quick. Fine. Yeah. But like, I know those things are true. But in my heart, it's sort of like, if I really get to thinking about it, like, if I'm laying in my bed, like, is it just nothing? Is it just nothing?
Yeah.
Is it just like I'm here now and then it's like nothing? Do you do that game? That's a fun game.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, I also think like it will be terrifying no matter how much work one does around it.
Might be easy.
Yeah. I don't know.
If you don't know it's coming.
That is a blessing. I do think it is a blessing.
For sure.
Well, but I guess that's what I'm saying, though, about the sort of fear of aging and also putting old people in places that are easier for us to, like, contain them and to contain aging, because we don't want to look at it. We don't want to look at the body failing.
What a ripoff, man. You go through your whole fucking amazing life, and then your family just puts you in this place with strangers? Like, maybe you couldn't get along with people your whole fucking life, and there you go. There you go. You're in a room with that guy.
I know. Work it out. Work it out.
We'll be back in a week. You'll like it.
Yeah.
That's your payoff? For making it that long?
I
don't want to be glib about it, because I know a lot of people don't have choices around that stuff, and you know, you got to do what you got to do. But It just seems to me that the entire undertaking, this isn't another problem.
Yeah.
This is getting heavy.
I'm ready for it.
Is like, is it, what is the fucking payoff?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what it's like to be that old, but I do think that the elderly have a lot to offer.
For sure.
I think personally, I'm so obsessed with, I think I'm a very vain person. I'm obsessed with how I look. I'm very aware of that. I think I spend a lot of time on it.
Yeah.
I think there might be something really freeing about letting that go.
You can do it anytime.
Not right now. Not with this book coming out in the national press, I have to do. It's not a good time for that, Mark.
No good time to just let it's the hair like, go and no makeup?
No. That's not today. That's not today. It never feels like the right day. And by the way, I respect those choices. Well, okay, let me be clear.
I don't know what my mother's real hair color is.
I never knew what my mother's real hair color was.
No idea.
Yep.
I know what it probably is now.
What is it now?
It's got to be gray.
Oh, okay.
It's blonde.
Well, that's a big decision that women make. So Paul's mother, and not his mother, his stepmother, just went gray. And that's a big thing
not
for women.
Not in Canada.
Everybody's gray?
A lot of gray in Canada. It's perfectly normal and nice looking.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
I think a chic gray bob looks great.
Right. Just not, you're against a kind of messy gray.
I'm not against it at all. Again, I don't have the courage.
You don't have to do it yet. You're young.
Well, here's the thing. I also enjoy, I enjoy makeup. I enjoy all of the sort of trappings and prison of my own making there. Mm. So it's complicated.
No, I understand. So outside of the activism right now, this is something you sort of evolved into. Like you've done a lot of like stuff. You were like, you started at where? UCB, right? You were UCB mm-hmm. born, mm-hmm. like, or Tisch school.
I started at Adler at Tisch, and then.
Adler at Tisch, is that different than, is that the acting program, or was that a separate?
So Adler's,
is that sort of like the Green Berets?
So Tisch has the drama department, and then I think they, I actually have no idea what they
it's
have
like
now.
The special
but
forces, like the Adler. You got to really
so
go
sad.
In deep.
Adler was known for, like, the different acting students were in different studios, and Adler students were known as, like, bringing a lot of props for their scene work.
No kidding. That was their reputation.
That was our signature.
Here she comes with the cello.
For whatever reason, we would have to set up scenes and bring, I remember bringing, like, a desk from my dorm room. Like, what was I doing? To set the scene, we were all about, like, you have to have all of the stuff.
That was an instruction?
Yes, for our scene study classes when we were doing
Three
Sisters.
They're going to steal your way of talking and make you bring desks?
And make you bring furniture.
This sounds fishy.
Yeah.
This was the method?
75 grand a year.
This was the method?
It was a part of it, which now seems insane. Like, we couldn't imagine that those things were there.
Well, no, it's nice to have them, but you would have thought they'd have them around the theater.
Yeah, no.
Like, available.
No.
Like, a desk.
People
like
were bringing
general.
Lamps.
They didn't have fucking lamps and chairs and a desk or two.
No, they weren't available.
A couch?
No, it wasn't
for
like-
scene study?
Nope. Maybe there was one couch that was used for, like, cross-period scenes.
Mm. All right. And that was a two-year thing?
That was 4 years.
4 years of bringing your own desk?
Yeah. It sounds insane. I mean, I remember because Casey and I- On September 11th, I was at NYU. I think we were in our last year there. We must have been in our last year.
Yeah.
And we got into the Tisch like showcase where agents were coming.
Oh, yeah, those.
And I had an internship and I was in the subway when, well, let me be clear.
Yeah.
I was, when I got out of the subway
on
57th Street,
yeah.
I heard that a plane had crashed into the building. And I was carrying all of our props. So I think I had with me like a lamp and like an ottoman. Like I was carrying, and then once everybody realized what was happening, I had to get to this, my boss's apartment on the Upper West Side, who very kindly let me stay there.
Because while your house was downtown?
We lived in Brooklyn, so we couldn't even get there.
Oh, right.
And I just remember carrying like all of our props through Central Park.
The worst day.
Oh my God, the worst day. And at that time, thinking we're under attack. Like at any moment, another plane will fall out of the sky.
Yeah. But you got your ottoman.
You got for dear life.
Did you create some sense memories that day?
Maybe that's what's right there.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why you're crying during massage.
Probably.
Because like you, that day you couldn't be as present as you wanted to be.
That's probably right, Mark.
Because you were worried about the props.
Yeah, and why was I still? Why wouldn't I have abandoned them?
Well, they were probably things you wanted.
I think they were NYU property.
Oh, they were. They were dorm room props?
I think so.
But no, they couldn't be. You were living in Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah. I guess we were in an apartment then.
Oh, my God.
I don't know.
Really,
they weren't
schlepping
mine.
Shit.
Oh, yeah. We would schlep shit all over town.
So you did 4 years of this. Mm-hmm. How'd it go for the showcase?
Not well. We didn't get it. Well, we didn't get into the showcase. And when we auditioned for it, we had to, I think we did two scenes, one from that Diana Sun play, and then when we changed, we had to change into another costume and come back for the other scene. And when we left, I remember staring at Casey and like her fly was open, just open.
Yeah.
And then her blouse was like completely mismatched. And I knew we were in trouble, that we had not presented our best selves. It was very hard. I mean, it was a very competitive.
But you did it together?
Yeah, we did it together.
With the two, like you were a team in college?
We weren't a team in college, but we were best friends, and so we were very
connected.
So you
were there together, but you did scenes together?
Yes, we did a scene because we were trying to get into this showcase, and you could do scenes.
With somebody, yeah. Oh, okay, all right. And you just knew, in your guts.
Yeah, I knew.
Wasn't your night.
No.
So you graduated without representation.
Without representation, and then we started. It was really Casey who found UCB, and
was this the old one, the original one, down in the 20s, 23rd?
This is the one, yeah, under Gracides.
Oh, no, that's a different one.
That was the second one.
Right,
we weren't at the first one. And we started writing a sketch show before we found UCB, and somehow, some way, because I had never taken a class there,
yeah,
we got the Thursday night 8 p.m. slot to do our sketch show
and
there.
And that's a big deal?
Yeah, it was a really big deal because we weren't like homegrown.
Right, okay.
So it was a very big deal for
outsiders.
Us to have that show, yeah. And then from there we started taking classes.
Yeah.
So it was just a strange way in.
And you went through the whole process?
Went through the whole thing. We went to the Aspen Comedy Arts Festival.
Oh, what year?
I think it was the last year.
Yeah.
Maybe second to last year.
Right, yeah. What came out of that?
Well, we got agents, and we started writing.
With the same agent?
Still with the same agent.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Good for you.
Yeah. And yeah, that was the beginning of all of it. I mean, it was interesting because at the time, you know, we only wanted to have the sketch show to feature ourselves as performers and actors and just get acting agents.
Right.
And we were pursued only by the lit agents of all the big agencies, which I remember taking as a huge insult.
It's actually a compliment.
I know. But at the time, I was like, we're not attractive enough. Like, we've got to accept
God.
It. We have to accept it, Casey. Like, we're not attractive enough to be actors. And we are being told that.
No, that's
it's devastating. Oh, we were.
You guys really
were devastated.
You really are like the characters in Ass Backwards on some level?
At that time, we were. That was autobiographical. We were so upset. And now, of course, I'm like, that was so insane. But
what was that? But that movie, like, were those characters that you had created? Were those existing characters?
No.
No.
They were sort of based on our time in our 20s and just what we were up to in the East Village of New York. But
okay.
They weren't, yeah.
Yeah.
They weren't like characters we did in our show.
Oh, they
anything.
Weren't. But that experience of making, like, you know, after, I mean, you did a lot of stuff. You seem to work a lot. You're one of the cool kids. What did you do in Zodiac?
I played Mark Ruffalo's wife.
Oh, I gotta see that again.
Mm-hmm. Very small role.
Oh, it was?
Mm-hmm.
Was that fun though? Dark Fincher? Did you have to do a million takes?
Yes. And it was the first job I ever had.
Have you talked about this on your show? The number of takes you did with Fincher?
I have, actually.
So you did a little?
I mean, I love him so much, and he was so kind. He was actually so kind to me.
David Fincher.
Yes. I just didn't. That was the first professional job I ever had in front of a camera.
Uh huh.
And I was doing 40 takes. Minimum.
Do you know I did 2 hours with him in the garage and he wanted to do it again? So we haven't released it. I have a David Fincher interview in the can because he wasn't happy with it.
That's crazy. I mean, that all lines up. Wow.
But you had a good experience, huh?
No, I remember finishing and thinking, like, I don't want to be an actor, I guess. I don't want to do film. Like, this, yeah. I thought that's what it was.
Yeah.
It's
kind of weird,
right? To
do a
movie. Yeah.
It's, like, stifling. Because you
listen,
kind of...
I love his movies. I think he's a genius.
I'm just talking...
I was so paralyzed by him.
I'm just talking camera work in general. It is disillusioning. You know, there's sort of the continuity of doing the work. It's where you really realize, like, you know, your romantic idea that you come into it with when you do plays or whatever you think being a star is going to be, it becomes a job real quick.
Yeah, real fast.
You know what I mean? Like, are we going to do that again? Oh, really? That was so good.
Yeah.
And then by the time they go, that's it. That's good. Well, that's a take. And you're like, that was the worst one.
I know. And then also, I really struggle with just like the big vacuous lens and just feeling comfortable with that.
What, just a camera, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
I never know. I'm not real good at knowing what camera's mine or whether it's on me.
Oh, I ask immediately. It's the first thing I ask.
I know. I should do it more. But I think I always give it my all every time. I'm better now.
I do with, not.
Oh. I know. I know. When they're doing my coverage. I'm not dumb.
The reason why I do ask sometimes, though, is because if I want to improvise or find something that I know is going to screw someone else up, I wouldn't want to do it in someone else's take.
Right.
Like, I can use that editing brain of like, oh, they'll never use that there.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I don't want to mess up their side of it.
Right. Yeah, it's nice. Yeah, it's like it's a tricky business.
It is. It's so technical. I think that's what people don't understand. It is so, it's such technical work.
Yeah, when you start to do take after take and you're like, what was wrong with that one? We had a lighting thing. Like, what does that mean?
What does it mean?
How could you have a lighting thing?
I never believe them when they say that.
I should stop believing.
I think they're just saying it to protect.
Oh, man.
Protect us.
So what was the big... Like moving out of, so you met Paul there at Uprights. And you guys fell in love?
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. Were you doing?
Yeah, it's best.
How did it happen?
Well, we were both dating other people. We both just come out of long relationships and.
You were dating other people or you were coming out of a relationship?
Both. We were both heartbroken from very long, intense relationships.
And you were just in the process of using people to feel better.
That's correct.
Okay.
I mean, we... yeah, yes.
Okay. It's fine. It's the way it goes.
It is.
I've been used and I've used.
You know what I mean? Like,
we've all used
you're,
and we've been used.
Absolutely.
It's okay.
It is. It really is okay.
It's hard. It's hard being a person.
It is. So we were just friends and he was giving me and Casey notes on our sketch show. Mm-hmm. Owen Burke, who was the artistic director of the theater at the time, said you should bring in Paul. He'll give you some feedback. I mean, we had come from NYU, so all of our sketches were like 20 minutes long.
Right.
You know, we'd written all these one-act plays and he was like, they cannot be longer than 3 minutes. And so we were, I'd never written a sketch before. So Paul just gave us notes.
Yeah.
I don't think we took any of them, but we became friendly after that. And then we would just hang out all the time. I mean, it's a real like friendship turning into something after probably about 6 months.
That's nice.
This, yeah.
And it stuck.
It did.
And it's been how many years?
So this October we'll have been married for 10 years, but together for almost 15.
That's a big one. What is that one? Like the paper one or what's the 10?
I don't know.
You don't know
those things?
I don't know. Yeah. Well, you subscribe to 10. That's a real number.
That's a real number. Yeah.
And you have kids who are how old?
5 and 3.
Oh, so they're less than, they don't require the full on baby stuff anymore.
No, but it's.
3's young.
3 still young, and there's a different level of engagement now. It's
they're people.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're like, oh, I'm the steward of your childhood. Like you are having memories and
And they have personalities. How's the personalities turning out?
Wonderful.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean it's such a
can you see a sense of humor and like, you know.
Yeah, totally. I mean the oldest is much more internal and much more sensitive.
He's 5?
And feels very deeply and is like connected to what other people are experiencing.
Yeah.
And the younger one just like is all physicality and like
yeah.
physical instinct and yeah. eating and wants to touch soft things and just is of the body
That's
so
funny.
Much,
That's
you know?
Right. My cousin's got a pair like that, two yeah. boys. One sort of sensitive, artistic. Yeah. The others are just a brute.
Yes. It's amazing to see.
Two profoundly, the two sides of the male archetype.
Yes.
Represented.
Yeah.
In your house. But you still work a lot.
Yes. Do you think I would stop working because I had children?
No. It just sounds like a lot of work.
Oh, yeah. It is a lot of work.
Yeah. I don't know if I was trying to imply that. Let me try to investigate.
I wonder, the only thing I would ask you is, would you ask a man the same thing? Are you still working with young children? Because I do think, I get the question a lot when Paul and I are out together, like they'll, just reporters will ask me, where are the kids? You know, they'll never ask him questions like that. So I do think there's a lot of assumptions about women and mothering where we want them to be working, but we're concerned.
I guess I think it was more like who chooses to do what? Do you know what I mean? Like, I think people make, like some people, like I don't like know where you're at with that. I don't think I was trying to suppose that you shouldn't be working, but some people choose to mm-hmm. do like something with their kids. I don't know how people handle kids. I don't have any.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I do choose to be with them a lot, and it's very challenging.
Yeah.
And I think most, I think the troubling thing is like a lot of women are in this position where you're kind of apologizing for working and then
sure.
also apologizing for spending time with your kids. So you're not, there's not a lot of understanding and support for, I mean, I even have trouble with the term working mother.
Yeah.
As though mothers who stay at home aren't working. I mean, they're doing harder work than I'm
oh
doing,
my
certainly.
God. I can't imagine.
But I can't imagine it, and I don't want to do it.
Right.
But it weighs on me every day. I think it's sort of a tension I just live with, which is how, and also like trying to kind of investigate my own ideas of time and
yeah.
like is valuable time spending like 8 hours a day with them. I don't know because I don't think I'm offering them the best of myself.
Yeah, I don't think my parents are around much at all.
I mean, I had two working parents.
Yeah, right, exactly. And we are okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why people ask that question. It's a little weird because like my parents, my dad was certainly never around, and I think my mom really tried to keep herself busy.
Did she not work outside the home?
What was she doing? She used to substitute teach. She didn't really engage in real jobs until I got older.
Yeah.
Until they got divorced, I think. So she was around, but, you know, not hanging out with us that much.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what she was up to.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's probably, I would have a hard time being with my kids
yeah.
every second of the day. That's not something I want to do.
No, of course
not. I don't
think
that's the best thing for them
either.
Who
the fuck would want to do that? Yeah. It makes it inappropriate. My mother was around a lot when I was three, but by the time you're like eight, it's like,
yeah.
Oh my God, we can destroy them.
Yeah.
I fully support your need and desire to not spend time with your children.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm passionate about it.
Yeah, it's good. I think it's a great cause. I think more mothers should just not spend time with their kids. But now this Grace and Frankie thing has gone on a while.
Yeah, we're in our, season six is coming
wow.
out and we'll start shooting.
They're just going to keep going, huh?
Yeah. Well, I don't
know
about
amazing.
That.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I mean, it's like, I can't imagine what that whole feeling must be to work with those particular women.
It's amazing. crazy.
I've talked to Jane Fonda. Lily apparently doesn't like to do these things alone. So,
did Lily do it with Jane?
No.
Sorry. Okay.
That was offered.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I can't, I don't want, it wouldn't be fair to either of them.
Yeah.
Or
I
me.
That. Yeah.
You know what I mean? I understand it's easier.
Yes.
But
always
Jane
easier
was,
to have a friend.
Yeah, kind of. But like, it gets a little weird if you want to ask, like, okay, this is for Jane. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
You be silent.
Yeah. Jane and I had great, that was a great time
She's
for me.
Incredible.
Yeah. And Lily, I think, would also have a nice time, but I don't know why she won't do it. It's okay.
Yeah.
But what have you, like, in terms of, like, coming into this after having a certain amount of experience yourself in doing television of different sorts, what are you taking away from working with these two particularly amazing women?
A lot. I feel, I think they've really taught me to be a lot braver as a performer.
And oh, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. And to not be afraid, to stop worrying about doing it right or pleasing the director. That for me, that was a really hard, like, muscle to get rid of. The idea of, like, oh, I want to be right. I want to be a good student here.
Right.
I want to do the right thing for the people who need it to be right.
Right.
You know, I think they're both so comfortable in failing.
Right.
And that has been the biggest lesson for me. Of, like, oh, it doesn't have to be right. I should be failing actually every day here.
Right. Just taking chances.
Yeah.
And also, they've got nothing to fucking lose.
It's extracurricular for them at this point. I mean, they're literally doing it because they want to.
Right. Yeah.
You know, which for me has been so amazing to be around. I feel like on other things I've worked on, just talking to actors and stuff, everyone's kind of listening to what other people are auditioning for or getting or what's going on. And on Grace and Frankie, like, they're there.
Yeah.
You know, they're so fully, like, there.
Right, yeah.
This is the thing that's going on. It's not outside of here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's so refreshing, and it's the way I want to work from here on out. And it's amazing.
And when you go out into the world, do you have a lot of nice, like, middle to older ladies that are like, there's that lovely lady from the
show. I have. Yes, totally. But people have a love-hate relationship with my character, so they love her.
Yeah.
But they're also, you know, like, why are you so mean? You're such a bitch. Yeah. Like, you know, so it's both. I get both things. But, yeah, the fan base is crazy for the show. And it's not just older women. I've been shocked at how many 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds watch the show.
That's great.
Yeah, they love it.
But it also speaks a little bit to what we're talking about in terms of the elderly.
Yes.
Great
Absolutely.
Examples.
Great examples and examples of, like, see, that's why I think Grace and Frankie, in its own way, doesn't get, like, the critical love. It doesn't get all of the sort of zeitgeisty stuff.
No.
But I do think in its own, well, it has a huge viewership, but in its own way, it's actually very quietly subversive and is presenting another option for aging that looks different, that's outside of a nuclear family, that's outside of, like, a traditional partner, that's two friends living together, taking care of each other.
Yeah.
And are sexual and are angry and are all the same, are every emotion.
Yeah,
you know?
they're fully rounded humans.
Totally.
These older people.
Yes, and but since the Golden Girls, I mean, that hasn't really.
That's true.
They've
yeah.
been a punchline, but they haven't been real characters.
Right. I think the Kaminsky method's trying to do that.
Yeah,
too,
I haven't seen it.
Well, it's, you know, it's a little sticky, but it's good. Yeah, it's Alan Arkin and Mike Douglas.
Oh, what could be? Yeah, I mean,
what
I watched
could be
that.
Bad? Yeah, I think you guys should do a crossover episode.
Oh my god, that would be incredible.
It'd be kind of hilarious, wouldn't it?
They just meet. Yeah,
but that's a steady gig, and that's great. Do you do the podcast? Is that weekly?
Oh no, we all. I mean,
how did this get made?
Yeah, how did this get made? We do once a month.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So that's a fun thing.
That's just a fun thing.
Hmm. But my producer Brendan listens to it regularly, and he said that, you know, you, over the last couple of years, he can feel the sort of the pull of politics and doing the right thing.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Which would where you just sort of like, and it's like, oh, June seems to be, you know, talking about some real shit over there.
Well, as the only woman on the show, there are times where I actually don't feel like it, but I then feel sort of I must address some of, you know, and. And yeah, certainly I don't think, I mean, what choice do we have but to address?
Well, that's it. But that, well, I know that's the thing though. Like, it's a weird thing that I've been experiencing on stage and certainly on this show, which I, you know, I used to do politics when I was younger. I mean, I did talk radio for fuck's sake, for, you know, lefty talk radio. And we made a decision coming into this show to not do that, to make it more existential and make it more about human stuff. But then it just got to a point where, like, you almost feel shitty for being entertaining. Mm-hmm. Like, in a way, it's sort of like our job is to entertain. But it's like there's part of me that's sort of like, haven't we been entertained enough?
Yeah.
Isn't entertainment time over? Isn't the puppet show done now?
Yeah, recess is done. Let's get back in there. Yeah, I totally understand that.
Well, I assume that's where this book came from.
Yeah, although I think the book is funny, too. I mean, I don't see the book. I think the book is taking a pretty dry subject, which is running for office.
Represent
and how
the woman's guide to running for office and changing the world. I mean, it seems real.
Yes, it is totally real, and it's tangible, and it's like factual, and it's something you can kind of sink your teeth into.
Were you brought in to be the funny person?
No, the book was my idea, but I brought Kate Black in she was working on Emily's List at the time. And I mean, originally I was just calling to say you should do this book.
Right.
This is a book idea.
Personal stories, ways to get involved. Like these are like, I think very few people, men and women, know the sort of way in or the import of their civic duty.
Well, and I believe that that's intentionally so. I mean, we don't really teach civics anymore.
Yeah, of course it's intentional, but by the wrong people.
Of course.
Yeah.
There is a sense that there's a luxury to leading, that you have to be all these things. You have to have all this money and you have to have degrees until you could possibly
No, you just have to be a
way.
Corrupt piece of shit that is willing to
sell their
soul.
That's the other thing. Like, I do think that a representative government is a better idea.
Sure.
You know, I just believe that. And I also think we shouldn't keep this process away from people. There's actually nothing mysterious about it.
Right. But it was always a matter of the interest level. I mean, it's like I guess what you're saying on one side of it that you have to be qualified. But I think more the problem is like, you know, don't you have higher aspirations, you know, than to be a fucking congressperson? Like, I think that's part of the brain that's the worst part. It's not like I'm not qualified to do it. It's sort of like, I'm going to sit in those meetings all day long. I'm going to listen to, like, you know, people complain about their buildings. And you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's a duty that you have to believe in and want to do more than anything else, which I think is probably the bigger obstacle than feeling qualified.
Well, it's interesting because women also have different obstacles and different barriers. And there are very real external barriers. They have a harder time fundraising. They have a harder time like fundraising early, which can then really negatively impact them.
Right.
So that's just real. And that's just data
practical.
In the book. Yeah.
Right.
But then there are the internal struggles of not feeling qualified. And men usually feeling qualified, even the men who don't necessarily feel qualified, and that this is data in the book, would even consider it. Whereas women who are overqualified don't think they are at all. So there are those internal struggles that are gendered and are specific. Women need to be recruited. Also, men usually do run for office for career reasons, as a step in their career, where most women run
because they've had enough,
because they've seen a problem and they want to fix it. Right. So, like, we should really be encouraging women to run.
No, absolutely.
You know, because they're more prone to run for reasons that I think we would want them to run for.
Because they believe in the system and then they make change.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think that.
And I don't want to fall into, like, an essentialist trap, because there are women leaders who don't advocate on behalf of women and children. And
sure.
So that's also true. But I absolutely believe that a representative government's a better idea.
Than what?
Than the one we have.
What do we have?
We have a government that's majority white men.
Oh, okay. Representative. Oh, yeah. You're not saying democracy. You're saying
no. We do have a democracy. Okay. But
right, it's not. Yeah. Doesn't represent the numbers of the right. It's not equal representation.
Yes.
Got it. Right. I agree with that. And but I do still think, like, you know, like, even me, I think, like, you know, who would want to fucking do that job?
Just do the job. Yeah. I mean,
why don't you?
I very well may.
I think you should.
Yeah, I'm definitely open to it. Like, that's sort of in the spirit of inquiry why I wrote the book. Because after the election.
Where would you start, do you think?
I don't know. Probably locally. Mm. I mean, there's homelessness in LA really interests me. There's a lot that I feel passionately about.
Oh my God, the heartbreak involved in being ideologically progressive to fight those fights. You know, like, and listen to me. I'm not, I can talk. But to the nuts and bolts of, like, you know, fighting those fights in within the government, mm-hmm. you gotta have some steam, man.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's, like, also a tension in the book, which is how do you dismantle these systems? Are you better off from the inside or the outside? Because there are a lot of fucked up systems in place, you know, campaigning, money, all of it.
Yeah. Can you be of more help, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I'm being so cynical. I think there's hope, and I think that people should.
I do too.
I think that people should get involved.
I do too.
I think when I talk like that, I'm like talking to myself. It's like, you piece of shit. You don't really give a fuck, or you do something. I'm like, I'm doing it. I'm talking. Not enough. Get involved.
That's hilarious.
Don't you have those conversations?
Or
you're doing things. You feel like you're doing enough.
I don't feel like I'm doing enough now, but I feel like I'm doing things.
Did I read somewhere that you do some other, like, volunteer work or some other sort of, have you helped, are you helping
have
somehow?
I helped people.
Are you helping?
I'm doing the best I can. Yes, I'm a part of an activist group in LA that is mainly comprised of progressive women who live on the East Side, and we do all sorts of different things.
Yeah.
Registering voters.
Yeah,
postcarding, all sorts of
That's
different
good.
Actions.
Yeah. Do you have hope?
So much.
That's good. You have to, right?
Yeah, of course. To me, that's just a choice. Like, of course I do.
Which way do you want to go?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a crossroads.
Yeah. I mean, the sort of planet in crisis is much more dire to me, so that's where I have a harder time finding hope. But I actually have a lot of hope for just people and conditions. And
yeah, maybe eventually over time they'll do the right thing, right in time for us all to be on fire.
Yeah. Yeah.
We finally worked out our problems. Oh my God!
Here it is!
All right, that's a good way to end. Do you feel good?
I feel great.
Did this go all right?
I think so.
I feel like it did. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
No, I know. I know. I feel good about it. I feel like we got over tension that wasn't even there.
I really didn't have any tension.
I didn't either.
I mean, I have to be honest with you. My tension was with, like, the administrative people I was emailing with.
It
really was very separate from you.
Right, because I think both times I've seen you recently...
But those are really the only times I've seen you. So I'm curious what other times you're thinking of.
No, those are the only times. But what I'm saying is I've gone up to you both times and said, are we okay?
I feel like I said...
Of course you did. Yeah, I know. But, you know, I'm just...
I know.
When was the last time I saw you?
I saw you at South by Southwest.
Oh, in Austin. That's right.
We
were there for a while.
Yeah. And backstage. Then I saw you at the Texas Film Awards there for Brooklyn Decker.
That's right. You did that with her. And then I saw you at a Netflix party.
I saw you at a Netflix party where Martin Sheen walked up out of the car.
Oh, yeah.
And I felt very, I don't know if you remember that interaction, but I felt very responsible for his experience.
No, it was weird. What did happen? Because we were standing there.
Nothing
and
happened.
Were...
We were just standing waiting for the car and Martin Sheen got out of the car. And I was also like, is he going to remember me? Like, am I going to be so out of context that I'm going to reveal this in front of you? Like, my co-star of 5 years is not going to know my name right now. Mm. So I was worried about that.
Yeah.
But I just felt...
And did he? I can't remember.
He did. I just felt... He did. I just felt very responsible for his experience there.
I get that, too. That's a weird kind of code. There's certain people...
Yes, who bring that out in me.
Yeah, I have a couple of them where you're just immediately kind of protective and bizarre.
I was like, I can't let him go in there.
Right, yeah. There's like two... Like, I know who they are where I don't even think twice about... Sort of like, I'll take care of it. Are you okay?
I know.
I'll give you. And it's weird people, too. They're not like necessarily...
What you'd expect.
Right. They're not really people that I'm necessarily close to, but there's a couple of people where I'm just like, I immediately step into that role. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
All right. Well, okay.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
It's nice talking to you. That was nice. I think we settled some things and talked some... I like her. I like everything about that person. Her book, Represent, The Woman's Guide to Running for Office and Changing the World,
is available. All right. Stratocaster. Wah-wah pedal. Old ass amp coming at ya.
Boomer lives.